Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Okay, so welcome everyone to this New Books Network podcast on Japanese studies. My name is Felicity Stone Richards. I am here interviewing two wonderful scholars who have edited a collected volume called Trans-Pacific Correspondence, Dispatches from Japan's Black Studies. Here with me, I have Professor Yuichiro Onishi, who is Associate Professor and Chair of African American and African Studies at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and Professor Fumiko Sakashita, Professor of American Studies at the College of Letters Ritsumeiken in Kyoto. Professor Onishi, Professor Sakashita, thank you very much for agreeing to join us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Felicity. Thank you for having us.
So, as we get started, Trans-Pacific Correspondence, Dispatches from Japan's Black Studies. This is a collection of basically an area of Black Studies that is not well known. The scholarship, the engagement of Black intellectual thought by Japanese scholars and, you know, non-academic Japanese people, writers in Japan. So just to get started with, why did you decide to do this project? What was the motivation to publish this collection?
You're right about the history of Black studies in Japan is really largely unknown in the English-speaking world. And personally, I mean, I was quite surprised to learn that it has been around for a long time, actually, and that it was established in 1954. This book sort of came into being during the period in which we were, the organization was celebrating its 60th anniversary. And at that point, folks came together, Japanese scholars of Black studies and others too, scholars of Black studies based in the U.S. and elsewhere. Fumiko-san, maybe there are others too coming from other parts of the world?
Yes, not only from the U.S., but also from Europe, like Germany.
That's right.
And other Asian countries, I guess. And that particular 60th anniversary conference was the first time for us to start sending out these colorful papers abroad. Like before that, we have had invited, you know, scholars from abroad as a keynote, but you know, celebrating our 60th anniversary, we decided to kind of, you know, include or recruit more participants from abroad. So that was definitely a different kind of characteristics from our past conferences. And so that was part of the reason, I guess, why we kind of decided to work on this book project.
Right.
It started as a 60th anniversary collection by compiling those written papers, you know, presented by, you know, conference participants into this volume.
Right.
And yeah, throughout the journey, kind of the project completely kind of changed.
But yeah.
That was the initial purpose.
Yeah. But one thing that... Go ahead.
Just for our listeners, this is the 60th anniversary of the founding of the Association for Black Studies. So this is Kokujin Kenkyu no Kai, the Association of Black Studies, or Negro Studies, as it was called in the 50s. So, you know, I guess a good place to start would be, what is the Association of Black Studies? Why was it formed in the 50s?
Yeah, so I looked into it as a part of my book project on Afro-Asian solidarity, and I was completely, like, basically drawn to their very distinct intellectual authority that sort of that was so evident when it was founded. In 1954, the historical context, as well as political context from which Japanese intellectuals came together, convened, formed a study group and reading group, engaging in various Black texts, not just the literary texts, but political texts as well, and historical texts. And it came into existence really after Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. And they saw that as a kind of a critical opening for sort of a major dramatic kind of a democratic transformation in the United States, but world over, where race and colonialism is concerned. And these scholars, Japanese scholars, again, came together with this strong desire on their part to kind of really work through these texts that were, like, really not so available, readily available in Japan. One of the leaders that founded Kokujin Kenkyu no Kai, Japan's Black Studies, his name is Nukina Yoshitaka. Yoshitaka Nukina, last name is Nukina. Throughout, particularly in post-war year, pre-war too, he was in the orbit of Japan's Communist Party. And through that, he politicized and acquired his internationalist kind of perspective. But he was also an Esperantist. He immersed himself in a study of Esperanto, which is a sort of invented universal language that sort of challenged English as a universal language. And I was just so drawn to these kind of very curious origins of Japan's Black study. So I dug more deeply into the genesis of it all. And what I discover is that the Communist Party in Japan, but particularly in post-war, post-surrender, 1945 Japan, was an important wellspring of radical thought. And the Black thought, or what they call the Negro question, was one of the key components of their sort of a political project of emancipation. And a lot of the U.S. based or Communist Party of the United States, CPUSA literature on the Negro question basically kind of trickled into post-surrender Japanese society. And Nukina, sometime before 1954, and he wrote about this a little bit in the sort of a newsletter, but that he discovered Du Bois's pamphlet, the book called The Negro. And it's this very expansive book about the role of African peoples in the movement of world history, from the earliest moments in human history to that book was published in 1921. I forgot the specific year, but in the 20s. And it's this little pamphlet, but it's just an expansive book. And apparently that reading that book, discovering that book, which was translated into Japanese during the wartime, I think, and discovering that book completely changed this outlook on history and politics, discovered a world that he had never known. And at that moment, he decided that he had to create a study group or reading group. And that was the sort of the genesis of Japan's Black Studies. And thereafter, what's remarkable, and Humiko-san can attest to this, what's remarkable, it started at Kobe City Foreign Studies University. Is that how you translate it? Kobe Gaigo Daigaku.
Kobe City University of Foreign Studies.
Okay, that's it. Yeah. Yes. Yo, so that's where it started with students. Another important convener, co-convener, who went on to play an important role in Japan's Black Studies, is Hiromi Furukawa. Professor Hiromi Furukawa was also an important figure, student of Nukina, also Esperantist. He became a very important scholar of Langston Hughes and African-American literature. But what's cool about it is that both men and women participated, but ordinary people also participated in early years. So that too was a very, for me, key feature of Japan's Black Studies, that it sort of existed outside of the academy, even though it was certainly, you know, enabled by scholars. But it was very sensitive to creating a forum outside of the academy, which sort of like basically in sync with what Black Studies is. So Black Studies is really kind of counter-hegemonic. And I mean, again, it's not an intrinsic thing. I think it has to do with the political kind of orientation of knowledge production that kind of intrinsically led to the certain type of Japan's Black Studies space. And that too was a very much to me like important aspect of my discovery as far as Japan's Black Studies intellectual authority. Go ahead.
That's a very, very good summary and a very interesting point you make, because, you know, what I got from the book is that you had a lot of people engaging with Black Studies quite intentionally. It wasn't, look at this, you know, really cool music, or look at this really cool prose. It was, you know, they're already part of political movements. You know, they're part of Marxist groups, they're part of communist groups. They are obviously, you know, utterly dissatisfied with, you know, the American occupation, you know, with the support that the American occupation was given to, you know, the very militarists who were supposed to be kicked out of power and now back in power. So every part of this is, you know, a very intentional political project. And as you said, it's not just an academic one, it was a community one of a lot of people trying to, you know, strategize and theorize about what are we going to do with the world now? What are we doing in Japan now? Where is Japan going?
Right.
And I saw this also in the chapters that focus on the spread of Afro-diasporic feminist thought and the engagement of Japanese women. And I was hoping, Professor Sekeshita, if you could speak more now on the, the role that Japanese women played in disseminating, engaging with Black feminist thought. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can do it. No, I can do it. Fumiko-san, I can do it. No, May, you can chime in though, because you were trained by one of the key thinkers or the participants of Japan's Black Study, Professor Furumoto, a translator of a number of African American women authors and Caribbean women authors. Furumoto Atsuko, right? Atsuko Furumoto. Mm-hmm. This is a person that I also talk about in this collection, Trans-Pacific Correspondence, but one of the key members of early years of Japan's Black Studies, her name is Yoriko Nakajima, and she was already, she was exposed to Black radical space in the United States as a student studying abroad, political scientist studying abroad in Michigan. And thereafter, she immersed herself in the civil rights struggle in the South. And this is in like, you know, early 60s, 1960, 61. But anyway, she brought this knowledge because she came into contact with Robert Williams. And he's like, you know, lionized as this kind of important Black Power movement activist. But she brought this enormous knowledge and literature back to Japan's Black Studies space and engage the participants. So oftentimes we focus on the two founders, but particularly Nukina and Furukawa sensei, but Nakajima played a huge role. But anyway, the chapter that we're looking at focuses on, again, very distinct kind of Afro-diasporic feminist formation in Japan. And we focus on the exchanges of ideas and sensibilities between and among different Black women authors and Japanese scholars. But particularly, we hone in on this relationship between Paul Marshall and, as I mentioned, Atsuko Furumoto, the professor who translated one of Paul Marshall's novels, Praise Song for the Widow, is the book that Furumoto-sensei translated into Japanese. And eventually, Paul Marshall was invited to Japan as a keynote speaker at Japan's Black Studies annual conference. But in that talk, she said something very, to me, was very, very revealing. And she said that, "I've always wanted to go back to go to Japan as a little girl growing up in Brooklyn." And she used to dream about like digging a hole in the backyard of her home. And then eventually she would get to Japan. And so she kind of chronicled or shared with the audience in Japan her version of Japanese dream. But to me, that description really was compelling in that as I read more of her novels, her protagonist would always create a space of her own to be a Black woman, where one could be Black women unencumbered, free of all the sort of oppressive things that Black women were experiencing and subjected to. And that the hole that she dug in the backyard was one of those kind of, it's not an oasis, but something like that. She called it an escape hatch into another world. And what, to me, that metaphor revealed something about the coming together of Japanese women, authors, translators, and Black women artists and authors. And in this chapter, we wanted to capture that distinct space of belonging that allowed women on both sides to engage in the project of reclamation, their own agency. One of the collections that we kind of touched on briefly, thanks to Fumiko's translation, I was able to kind of get a glimpse into how other Japanese women writers engage with African-American women literature. But the principal editor named Fujimoto Kazuko put together this 7-volume Japanese translation of African-American women literature. So Alice Walker, Zola Neale Hurston, I should know this, but there are other authors.
Toni Morrison.
Paul Marshall wasn't there. Natsuke Shange's, piece was in there. But anyway, what she did was this Fujimoto, the principal editor, she paired translated African-American women literary texts with the accomplished, established Japanese women authors, and have had them read Black women's texts and then write reflective kind of essays in relationship to their own corpus that they produced. And I was really drawn to that, that type of very deliberate kind of engagement. And it reminded me of very much of the kind of praxis that Paul Marshall provided, which is that we have to dig a hole in the backyard, not in the front yard, but in the backyard. Very non-normative ways of thinking, backyard, so that we can dwell in our own space. She used to call it the VW room, reference to Virginia Woolf, a room of our own. But so I wanted to really kind of take that kind of a perspective and then lift it up to the realm of trans-Pacific correspondence, and that we were kind of exploring in the book, and it really carve out this very specific Afro-diasporic feminist inquiry that's pretty robust. And what you can see in that is a formation of very distinct genealogy of women of color feminism through Afro-Asian kind of conversations. But anyway, I had a really good time writing that piece, and thanks to Fumiko-san. Really, like, I was able to tap into the Japanese women's voices and this space, the cultural sphere, like no other. You know, they're so, like, grounded, you know, these Japanese women authors. Like, Furumoto-sensei, she was so totally humble, because we emailed her after, I mean, this is going to kind of a very informal conversations, but Fumiko sensei was mentored by Furumoto sensei, who, you know, translated Paul Marshall's and many other texts. But, and yeah, she was totally humble. But, you know, I really do think that they produce some seriously important stuff that are useful for us to think differently about how people mm-hmm. come together. But anyway.
I found that the concept of that Virginia Woolf room.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the space where those, you know, women of color, like, you know, Japanese women and like Black African American women imaginatively corresponded, right? Like it's not like a physical conversation. And I don't think we included that section where Furumoto sensei talked about how she used to read those, you know, novels in her kitchen.
Oh, that's, you know, right.
In the middle, like, you know, while you know, she, dealing with, you know, housework and stuff, you know, she was kind of finding this nick of time and, oh, you know, wow. Right, oh, right, right. So, and also maybe one of the female activists, Morisaki, what's the first name? So other women of color, like Japanese woman who wasn't really necessarily like engaged in like Black studies, but the other like activism in Japan, she was also kind of talking about the importance of this space, like kitchen for women, right? So, and like, you know, while we're kind of taking a look at those, you know, which like stories, you know, to include, you know, we quite often came across this like anecdotal stories of women, you know, doing something important or doing some very serious conversation in the space of kitchen or like, you know, backyard, right? Like, you know, it's not like the official or, you know, public kind of space. It's more like a you know, beauty parlor for like, you know, Black women and that kind of stuff. But like I found it quite very interesting, like fascinated by the fact that, you know, they kind of share that the space, not like physical space, but
you're right,
like an intellectual or, you know, imaginative space. So
that's totally right. And that I think when we're talking about that, Furumoto sensei and how she was basically, her process of becoming an intellectual was bound up with her, you know, child rearing and being a mother in the kitchen. And then we're also looking at Paul Marshall and how she herself became writer through the kitchen, like being together with other women from the Barbados who are all domestic workers in New York. But kitchen was a place where they could be free and be able to be themselves and engage in political conversation through anecdotal stuff, through gossip. But that's where she learned to become a writer, she said. You know, she called these women the poets in the kitchen, you know. But these are domestic workers who were subjected to basically kind of the modern day kind of slavery. Their day laborers being, you know, sort of sent to different white suburbia just above Bronx in Westchester County, probably in New York. I know I'm familiar with that area because I used to live in that Westchester County. But anyway, so they get hired as a day laborer to work in white homes. But then, you know, after work, sundown, then they'll come home. But on the weekends, they have the kitchen. And that too is, you're right, that's their space and where they can be human. You're right.
And this is precisely one of the things that, you know, feminists, this is the one thing that feminists of all sorts have been, you know, screaming about, to say like, there is no separation of the public and private sphere. Like, there is no space where politics isn't happening. And this is one of the reasons why I really love this collection, because you're showing that, you know, not only is this, you know, politics rife in this domestic space, but, you know, political development and evolution and intellectual discussion is also active in this space. It's not just the case that you have, you know, the, you know, patriarchal difficulties that are creating this space, but actually this space itself can be made into a creative hub by the women who populate it, which I thought was, you know, really extraordinary to show. And yes, to show the imagination, the creativity in that space. And this was actually, again, one of the things that was really good about this collection is that, you know, there's a, you know, wide methodological variety here. You have history, literature, theoretical engagement, and there is also, you know, this chapter that is an oral history. So these are interviews of a number of professors that were active in the Black Studies Association, each giving us, you know, a small history of their political evolution, at what, you know, what brought them into the Black Studies space, how did this space change them? And Professor Sagashi, I think you were, you know, active with putting together this section. If you could talk a bit more about, you know, some of the people you interviewed in this chapter, you know, why them, what were they talking about?
Yeah, the chapter on, well, it wasn't actually an interview. It was like a translation of written either autobiography or the talk they did at the JBSA's annual conference or like a monthly meeting. So we didn't initially plan to include this chapter, right? Like it was a kind of coincidence. There was another chapter first included in this volume that our publisher suggested us to kind of take out or replace with something else. And since we had already included in the introduction the brief autobiography of our own intellectual journeys as African-Americanist, I thought it would be great if we add more of these kind of stories from other JBSA members of particularly like earlier generation. And because we as scholars of Japan's Black Studies have been often asked and have constantly tackled this question of why we do what we do, right? Like why we non-Black, like Japanese scholars doing Black studies, African studies, or Caribbean studies. And we've been constantly asked why, right? And we've been constantly asking ourselves why. So that's partly why we decided to, you know, include our own stories. And so we thought, you know, it would be the readers would probably find it interesting to read other stories as well. And I knew some of the elder members who had served as either president or vice president of JBSA in the past had contributed their own autobiographical essays on JBSA journal, Kokujin Kenkyu, Japan, Black Studies. So, and back then I luckily served as Secretary General of the Association, and in my office I stored all the back numbers of those journals. So I decided to kind of thumb through the past back numbers and kind of was able to find these five essays, one already written in English because Furukawa-sensei presented that story at one of the annual conferences in English. I think that was at Hiroshima University or somewhere. And four out of five were written in Japanese, so I translated it into English. And so reading their, you know, each of their stories are different, right? But, you know, we see they also kind of had tackled this question of why, you know, they do what they do. So it was very interesting to see how they, when and how or where, you know, they became interested in this issue and how they were aware of, like, you know, becoming a scholar themselves of Black Studies. And I really wanted to title this particular chapter like When and Where We Entered, by kind of paraphrasing or like borrowing this phrase from Anna Julia Cooper's, you know, where and why, when and where I enter. So it's about individuals, you know, intellectual autobiography, or how one became the scholar of, you know, what particular field. But earlier generation, they are most of them, of course, this wartime experience, or, you know, after this occupation period, like experience, a huge impact on them, and particularly like Furukawa sensei. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, listening to other, like, you know, our elder members also talking about similar stories of how as young boys, you know, school students, they kind of saw this, you know, racially segregated military facilities, you know, set up for white soldiers and black soldiers, you know, in occupational, you know, Japan, like especially like in Kobe, where they lived. And so that kind of like a question really kind of made them aware of, you know, what was going on outside of the world. And so that was one of the, like, even before, you know, deciding to include this particular essay, like, I had always been interested in that particular experience. Like, for the first generation kind of JVSM members, like, racism and other issues wasn't necessarily like a second-hand information.
Right.
Mm. Unlike, yes, you know, like a later generation like us, you know, we weren't necessarily like, you know, experienced these things, you know, firsthand, but, you know, they witnessed it, right? Like, right, they were there. And so that was one thing that's probably different, difference between like our experience and their experience, you know, of becoming like a Japan Black Studies scholar. But yeah, so that was.
No, that's a really good point about the earlier generations. They actually witnessed domination and racial or otherwise, but sort of kind of dominate hegemonic thing that's controlling their lives. But then they were fed the ideals of American democracy, and then every day they're like in Kobe, they're seeing segregation in the military basis. And I mean, that must just like threw them off in different ways. But one thing the story that I like in the section that you know, translated is Kato sensei. And why do I study Black literature? And the fact that he lived in Manchuria, so that's Japanese colonial state, right? So he was a settler, Japanese settler colonial, you know, descendant of Japanese settler colonialism. Anyway, and then he came back and then just impoverished, you know, lived a very poor life, and struggled and survived. And then all of the Black literature kind of basically was his sort of a ticket to liberation and, you know, humanness. And to me, like he says, why did I turn to Black study? Why do I study? And it had to do with what kind of person am I? You know, that it's a very kind of deep philosophical, you know, who am I kind of question. It's about your own existence. And so that too is very, to me, like there's something there that's common theme feature in the Japanese scholars turn to Black thought or Black literature, Black knowledge. It a lot forced them to question their own kind of social existence. And oftentimes it gets political from there, but surely many of them are connected to like the left space, but that's, I mean, for us too, for me too, I mean, that's kind of persistent, like who am I kind of question, very, very much ontological kind of question. Yeah.
And so you speak somewhat in the collection, both of you, on how each of you also came to Black studies? Because obviously, you know, you're talking about this generational shift that, you know, the older generation lived through the occupation. They lived through having to struggle with, you know, what Japan did as an imperial power to other nations. And then they also witnessed, you know, Jim Crow American segregation and the treatment of Black Americans, you know, right in their home. So this is, you know, very, you know, very particular experience. Nevertheless, you know, go one generation next, we come to your generation that still manages to develop this relationship with Black studies. And I'm curious as to how that happens now without this older experience. You know, how are you coming to this?
I think we're kind of perhaps similar process, I guess. Like in my case, like you said, Felicity, that, you know, we didn't necessarily have that direct kind of impactful experiences, and like for, you know, first generation or second. I think we consider ourselves as third generation, I guess, among JBSA members. So it's totally different, but like in my case, it was like a coincidence. Like I had a fortune to be able to, like, you know, to see, I mean, encounter, like, you know, formal senses work, or, you know, I happened to enter the college where she was teaching, right? So her team taught course on human rights had a major, you know, gave me a major impact. And I wanted to learn more about civil rights movement and other stuff. But I was so naive and young that I wasn't really like aware of how this issue of, like, you know, racism and other like structural discrimination and stuff were like universal, or like how where I was situated in this whole system, right? Like, I wasn't really aware of my kind of role in this until, like, I started studying Black studies in the States at Michigan State University. Like, it was just in my case, it was kind of late, really late. Like, I was already, like, you know, in my early 30s when I finally was able to kind of see a parallel, or, you know, like a universality of this, you know, issue of racism and, you know, injustice, and then how I was kind of very in a complex position where I was considered as like a student of color or woman of color in the state, but at the same time I am a member of like majority, like dominant society in Japan. So I used to feel very uncomfortable when my friend in the States, you know, call me, like, you know, or like try to include me as like a people of color or woman of color. Or so I understand that the injustices and, you know, inequality as an international student, like female student, non-American student in the States, but you know, back home, my position is completely opposite, right? Like different. Mm-hmm. So that kind of very not necessarily complex, but it's like a contradictory kind of, you know, positionality made me always kind of aware of again this question of like why, you know, I do what I do, mm-hmm. and why this is important to me, right? Yeah. So no,
I totally echo that. That the Japanese-ness, that awareness, my awareness of Japanese-ness as a representing certain power. And for me, like, similar, I mean, I my entry into Black studies, Black history, Black thought, very academic. So exposed to readings that I've never been exposed to in college. And I, you know, studied history, U.S. history, labor history, you know, African-American history and all of that. Then I went back to Japan, and I have been away from Japan for a long time, ever since I was 12 or something like that. And I worked in a warehouse. And, you know, in the U.S., I studied white. We didn't really use white supremacy, but I was using whiteness and construction of whiteness as a political problem. And I went back to Japan, and I witnessed, like, racism in Japan, you know, like a real way. Like, so where I worked in the warehouse, next to it was foreign workers, like immigrant workers from Southeast Asia working in a meatpacking. And they're described in racialized ways. They're kitanai, kitsui, kurushi, 3K. They do 3K stuff. And the Japanese workers would be like, we're not like them, you know. And I'm like, well, this is like totally racial. But they were not thinking in those terms. But anyway, and then the warehouse, to get to warehouse, the bus, the public bus would take people through segregated Korean neighborhood in Kawasaki City. Like, that too, I never knew, you know. So I started to see Japanese-ness in a similar way as the whiteness, the construction through domination, you know, the difference constructed through domination. And so that point, I just became interested. Well, there's got to be some Japanese folks who are like aware of this problem and engaging in opposition and resistance. And then I started to kind of see these Japanese scholars, anti-imperialist, anti-war, anti-racist people, like a pockets of like a resistance in the recent past, like in the late 60s and 70s. So that was my kind of like entry point into doing Black studies in a way that kind of brought me closer to who I am and I guess where I belong, my position. It's very similar to Humiko-san. Like becoming aware of my own positionality in between U.S. and Japan kind of thing. And the Black studies was my kind of entry point to engage in sort of critique of both at the same time. Yeah. But
thank you. Yes, that is, you know, really what I think is most important about this collection. And, you know, with many of the other scholars who are now doing work in this, you know, Afro-Japanese space, to highlight that, you know, this isn't just a question of, you know, cultural exchange. Like there's a, you know, political evolution here that is at work with people who engage with Afro-diasporic thought. And for listeners, just really quick, the 3Ks, Kitanai, Kiken, and Kitsui, refer to dirty, dangerous, and demanding work. So, you know, it's a type of thing that certain ethnic minorities in Japan are associated with basically dirty work that nobody wants to do and really unpleasant, poorly paid, poor, you know, there's no permanent contracts, this kind of work. So one of the things that I guess as we, you know, approach the end, because we're talking about, you know, your engagement with this as stimulating kind of political awareness, political consciousness, of the situation of, you know, racism in Japan, you know, the hierarchical structure of Japan, is this still ongoing? Do you think this kind of engagement with Black studies today, where do you see the future of Black studies as this political interaction? Do you see this still ongoing?
I think so. Well, like, as for like JBSA, Japan Black Studies Association, it's their role, it has become slightly different, right? Like, you know, it started as like a civil, how do you call it? Like a civilian group, not necessarily like an academic group, like a group of people who are very aware of political. Situation and other, like, you know, issues. So earlier, you know, members were very much active in, like, you know, anti-war movement, student movement, and other kind of activism. So we're not no longer like that, because it has it has become more institutionalized, I would say. Like, you know, it's considered more as a, like, academic society, like academic association. Partially because the academic atmosphere has changed as well. Like, you know, like for junior scholars or other, like, you know, grad student, you know, they need to publish or they need to, you know, present yes. papers at the conference. That the association that has to be considered as, like, you know, academic rather than, like, you know, politically active, right? So yes. so that's just like a we kind of how do you call it, like, so we're aware of the importance of the both, but more kind of, you know, focus on this academic side. But that doesn't necessarily, like, you know, like, we are no longer active in that particular field, because I'll give you an example. Like, when the recent Black Lives Matter movement happened, when Mr. George Floyd got, you know, killed, the back then the contemporary president, the president of JBSA, you know, decided to issue the statement to its members about the inhumanity or, you know, injustice of against, you know, Black people. So that was just like a statement, but you know, he wanted to make sure that the association was aware of what's going on in the world. And you know, he was aware of the importance or role of, you know, our the group, you know, association with this very outstanding history of, like, activism, right? And even, you know, for those, you know, scholars of Black Studies who are not necessarily, like, our member, like the member of JBSA, particularly, like, you know, recent years, you know, they have been very aware of the importance or role of scholars, you know, in Japan doing Black Studies, Black History, especially when in the media or, you know, the public are kind of indifferent to the problem of racism or, you know, the issues of negative portrayal of, you know, people of color. So we've been doing what we can do, I guess, like, you know, through education or, you know, through like teaching our student, but also, like, you know, sending out some academic kind of, you know, input to the media, you know, through media. Like, you know, Yuichi-san, like, last week, you know, you were interviewed by, like, you know, one of the Japanese, you know, media, right? Like, about George Floyd case. So, you know, we've been busy, but we've been trying to kind of, you know, squeeze some time. And also, like, you know, we've been trying to do, like, a translating, you know, more work. Like, I think this past year, not only, like, you know, academics, but also, like, those professional translators have published, like, a lot of, like, translation of, you know, Black Lives Matter kind of related books. You know, those two memoir by Alicia Garza and Patrice Cullors that were published, like, recently, they have been already translated into Japanese. And also Tanas Coates,
Between the World and Me.
Oh no, that have been already translated. I'm talking about eight more years, or what was the word? The recent one. So, and also, like, Angela Davis or others, you know, they have been translated. More recent work have been translated into Japanese, you know, thanks to, like, you know, the interest, you know, among non-academic people. So
I should give credit where credit is due. So Fumiko-san was instrumental actually in doing this, you know, activism kind of in Japan. Japanese, major Japanese broadcasting station was airing really racist caricatured, anti-black caricatures in the media. And Japan's black studies scholars stepped up in a big way and pressured the most powerful broadcasting station, brought them to its knees and made him apologize. So that the media person that I was speaking to last week, he told me that he actually went to your seminars, which was a mandatory. The broadcasting station forced its employees, because they messed it up, so they forced its employees to take all these seminars taught by Japan's black studies scholars like you, Humiko-san. So he said he went to your seminar.
Oh, that's good. Well, but actually that letter was sent by 13 American studies scholars.
Oh, like, is that right? Oh, I see.
Yeah. Including me, like, you know, so I think we had three black studies scholars, like black African American history scholars, but not necessarily, like, you know, it wasn't about, you know, JBSA project.
Oh, it was about, right, that's right, yeah, that's right.
It was like American studies scholars in Japan.
Right. But yeah. Another thing that I should acknowledge, so because of that type of activism that she was part of, obviously the media and other sort of publishers or newspapers, presses, recognize the important voice that scholars like her is bringing to the public sphere. So, I mean, you were columnist too, right? For one of the newspapers, basically doing Black History 101 kind of column, right? So I think that's important, you know, to kind of acknowledge that, like, these scholars are kind of staking out new spaces to engage in this work of making known the centrality of race and racism in our experiences.
And yes, one of the amazing things that we did see from the, you know, Black Lives Movement in Japan is that you also have a lot of young people who are now claiming these spaces, you know, starting to rev up their fight against Japanese racism. Because, you know, you could see in all of the, you know, all of the mainstream discussion, one, it was already extraordinary that there was a mainstream discussion in Japan on anti-Blackness. I don't know if I've ever seen one that was so widespread, but you still had, you know, backlash from people who were saying, oh, but this is Americans' issue. What does this have to do with us? Why are you having these disruptive marches? And, you know, one of the things that the activists were pointing out was, like, one, you should have marches anyway, even if there were no Black people in Japan, even Japan did not contribute to anti-Blackness in any way, because, you know, this is America we're talking about. This is your main ally. You know, we are invested in this country. Therefore, we are, you know, a part of what this country does. Mm-hmm. But you also have the fact that there are Black immigrants in Japan. There are a number of half Black Japanese people in Japan, you know, who suffer their share of discrimination, mockery, bullying, and, you know, police harassment. So already the movement, you know, has really highlighted this. But again, it never stops with Black lives. You always have the connection to, and by the way, still racist against Koreans, still racist against Chinese, still racist against Ainu, Okinawans, you know, immigrant Filipino, Vietnamese workers, you know, as with, you know, BLM, the explosion of anti-racist work ends up bringing in everybody else, which I thought was really extraordinary and gives me, you know, a lot of hope for, you know, the spread of anti-racist movements in Japan.
No, that's a really, I mean, I think that's something that I hold on to as a thesis, which is the power of Afro-Asian connections. This Japan's Black studies, generally speaking, is one of the examples. But you're right, that they really do see race has nothing to do really with, like, skin color or biological thing, difference. They really do approach race as a political thing. It's a political category. So Blackness too, it has nothing to do with skin color, but it's a political kind of political category. So in those spaces, like BLM marches and demonstrations in Tokyo, what I mean, I wasn't there. I just watched some clips and stuff. It's incredibly multiracial, you know? And I think you're right that there's something there. The articulation of blackness is so inclusive. It's like the next closest thing to utopia almost. But it's a black space, like it's a BLM marches. And I think that's like the one of the major feature of Black Studies kind of intellectual thrust, or the movement, you know, Afro-Asian movement space in Japan is precisely that kind of coming together of just different people on political grounds. And yeah, that's a really cool part. Yeah, exciting.
Yeah. Blackness as a kind of utopia. I like that. I think that's a good, that's a good place.
Yeah, in Japan, it appears as a next closest, I really do, like a next closest thing to utopia. It's not quite utopia yet, but it's getting there.
Well, I think that is a perfect note to end on. Professor Onishi, Professor Sakashita, thank you so, so much. This is a very illuminating discussion. And just a reminder, the collected edition Trans-Pacific Correspondence Dispatches from Japan's Black Studies, which was published in 2019, please do pick it up. It is a superb collection and a really important, you know, history and theoretical engagement on Japanese Black Studies scholarship. Thank you again for agreeing to meet with me.
Thank you, Felicity. Thank you so much.